Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin along with John Krawczyk. And John, I heard a historian today saying a lot of people are comparing the moment that Joe Biden's going to be taking the presidency with FDR and all the problems he had coming out of the Depression. She thought a better comparison was the Square Deal by Teddy Roosevelt. And there was a lot of sectarian conflict in America at that time, urban versus rural. We were very divided, and we had industrialization really shaking up our world at the time, just as we have the technical revolution and AI really affecting our world today, let alone the pandemic. So she thought a better point of reference historically might be Joe Biden coming into office in the way that Teddy Roosevelt did. And I was saying to you before we began our recording of this, Teddy Roosevelt was a fascinating individual.
He was a very fascinating. They don't make him like that anymore.
Well, he was, first of all, an outdoorsman.
Right.
And can you think of any of our latest presidents, aside from on a golf course, being an outdoorsman?
No, none of them.
Really? I mean, think about it.
Well, wasn't it Dick Cheney? Didn't he shoot somebody with a shotgun out there or something? Somebody.
I don't recall, but I wouldn't call him an environmentalist. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt had a vision for America trying to set aside land and such. He was a unique individual. He really was. I mean, Jimmy Carter, in many ways, building homes and,
after his presidency, you know, he was, I thought he was a real failure as a president, but after his presidency, he's the only president you can really look to that's really done something great for everybody, for people in need.
Yeah, he's been terrific.
I mean, so.
But David Gessner has written this book, Leave It As It Is. And that is a quote. That is a quote from Teddy Roosevelt when he was giving a speech about the Grand Canyon. Yep. And this is before it was protected.
Right.
And he said, folks, leave it as it is. You can't make it any better.
Right.
You can only destroy what it is.
He's absolutely right.
Absolutely.
Leave it alone.
And, of course, I don't think he would have been terribly happy with some of the things that have been going on, even as we speak today about opening up the National
Logging
Arctic Wildlife Refuge to drilling. He would not be happy about that. Let's be honest about it. So
I don't think anybody should be, really.
I know, really. It's unfortunate. But he really was also a very complicated man because his sentiment about Native Americans is something that a lot of people have given him demerits for, and rightly so, that he really was a very prejudiced individual on that score. And he was a hunter as well as an environmentalist. But over time, again, some of his views did change. But I found him to be such a fascinating study. And David Gessner follows a journey that Teddy Roosevelt took through the American wilderness. When was the last time you knew of a president who slept outdoors, John?
None of them. None of them. I know.
Well, actually, Donald Trump may be sleeping on the lawn of the White House by January 20th. Unwilling to go. But anyway, well, listen. Let's listen to David Gessner. The book is called Leave It As It Is. And we will today on America Trends.
I welcome to America Trends David Gessner. And the book is called Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. And I love the title of the book. I love the concept of the book. And I'd love for you to explain the term "leave it as it is." Obviously, it was something that TR said, but put it in context for us, David.
Well, first, I found it to be a very handy phrase in many areas. Like when I got the box of books and my wife tried to take it off the dining room table. or as I said to you earlier, it works for bats and the coronavirus. I mean, we should leave a lot of things as they are. Roosevelt specifically said it upon standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon in 1903 and looking out over the canyon, which he was seeing that morning for the first time. And there was starting to be an encroachment of hotels and commercialism on the canyon. And he was saying, we don't need a hotel here. We don't need anything here. This itself is more grand. In fact, a lot of those early pronouncements were reaction against another park, Niagara Falls, that had gone so commercial that it became kind of the anti-park. And so Roosevelt thought, we want to leave it for our children's children's children as it is. And like I said, it's been handy. At one point, the publicist attempted to change the book title, and that's what I said to them too.
Well, they did leave it as it is, and I'm glad that they did. And I do want to ask you, because I've been to Niagara Falls, and I've been to the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon was several years back. How much commercialization has gone on around it? Because clearly it is an attraction. So tell us, I mean, that was Teddy Roosevelt saying that in 1903, I believe it was. So here we are in 2020. What does it look like today, at least the trappings around it?
Well, we certainly have the clusters and the Canyon Village. He was directly talking about things starting to be built down in it too, and on the very edge. You know, you could imagine a neon sign on the edge of the big hole here or something. And so we do have that, and I write about that in the book with regards to the Grand Canyon and to Yellowstone, where often you feel like you're in a wildlife traffic jam. You know, and so there is that aspect to it. But what you have to remember is, what was saved was not just the slim sliver that we're looking at, but the vast backcountry. So, for instance, in Yellowstone, 2% feels very car-heavy and with millions of visitors, and 98% is the realm of wolves and mountain lions and bears. So in that regard, though it feels kitschy and commercial to us, it's been vastly successful in terms of wildlife.
Now, Teddy Roosevelt was a complex individual, and you certainly do not avert your eyes from some of the things that have gotten a lot of attention of late about his treatment of indigenous peoples and the like. Having said that, he did some remarkable things in terms of leaving it as it is. And for a contrast, when we heard recently the current president saying Yosemite, and that gave you an idea about how far we have come from a concern about conservation, about preservation, land management, land use in the West. Because I think that's what drew you to take this trip to remake one of his tours, because you were so concerned about something that the Trump administration had done to turn back Bears Ears National Monument from what Barack Obama just did to preserve it.
Yeah, exactly. And you got to remember, he mispronounced it twice, because he also said Yosemite after he said Yosemite. And he also claimed he was the same or almost as good as Roosevelt as a conservationist, which is comical, of course. So, there were overlaps with Trump. You know, both are born in Manhattan with silver spoons in their mouths, both actually had small hands, believe it or not. But the differences are really what define them. And Roosevelt was always a grower. You know, he read a book a night. By the last time he ran, he had a platform that would have made Bernie blush. It was, you know, he hated...
With the Bull Moose Party, yeah.
Yes, exactly. He hated the elite criminal class, as he called it. And of course, even though the statue was taken down in front of the American Museum of Natural History, the Hall of Biodiversity was named after Roosevelt. So he had this deep love of wilderness that grew from his childhood ambition to be a naturalist. And what, you know, to work it back around to the native people and indigenous people, I do lay it out, you know, I lay out his flaws in the book and I call him out on it. But it's a strange book in this sense, in that the kind of co-stars of the book are Roosevelt and Regina Lopez White Skunk, who's a Ute Mountain Ute, who is one of the Bears Ears Intertribal Council members. And what I try to do in the book is take what was best. You know, I'm critical of Roosevelt, but I also think we can be critical of people while still looking for things we can use in the present. We can, you know, I go to biography almost selfishly, trying to find things in it for me. And so what I can use from Roosevelt is not just that fight that ended up saving 230 million acres of land, but this concept of the Antiquities Act, of putting land aside, of leaving it alone. And what I try to do in the book is create a confluence between that and this new idea that it's exemplified by Bears Ears National Monument, of the parks and national monuments growing out of native thinking and indigenous thinking. Whereas before we'd taken land from them to make our parks, Bears Ears was an example of five tribes getting together and using this American tool to save land that was grew out of the thinking of Native American thinkers. So it seemed really interesting to me, a new way to look at conservation, really.
Yeah, that was fascinating. The first time that Native American tribes, the five that you mentioned, were there to preserve that monument. And that really is indicative of the fight over the Antiquities Act itself. And you point that out as a really major goal that is ongoing in America today.
Yeah, well, what happened was, on the way out of office, Barack Obama, and this is a tradition with presidents to do, you know, I think on his last day in office, Roosevelt declared Mount Olympus in Washington. But on his way out of office in December of 2016, Obama declared Bears Ears National Monument. And for me, that was an exhilarating moment because I'd contributed to a book that had been distributed to Congress called Red Rock Testimony that was partly celebrating Bears Ears. And then this is in southeast Utah, full of, you know, Anasazi ruins and full of these kind of canyons that you drop down into rather than climbing a mountain, you drop down into the Red Rock. It's just a fascinating place that really is almost the definition of the Antiquities Act, in the sense that it's full of thousands of years of civilization, basically. So Barack Obama declares that, and then about 8 months later, 9 months later, maybe 10, I guess it is, October 27th, which would have been Roosevelt's 159th birthday, then Secretary of Interior Ryan Zinke undeclares it, standing in front of a portrait of Roosevelt and calling himself a Roosevelt Republican. And so for me, that was kind of a body slam. I'd been lifted up by the declaration and slammed to the ground by the undeclaration. And that's also kind of what spurred the book. And of course, what happened was many environmental organizations and Native American organizations took Trump to court. So all this time, the fate of the Antiquities Act has been being decided. And it's a huge thing, because if a president can undeclare land declared by a previous president, we enter a strange world of declaring and undeclaring, depending on who's in office. So that act, which is the single most powerful act a president has to individually, without Congress, preserve land, is a hugely important one. And that would taking it away would gut the environmental abilities and of the president.
Do you think that among the many regulations that this president has trumpeted, though he says that he's still protecting the environment in the process, he talks about water and he talks about clean air, but there are so many things that he's tried to overturn, something very recently that Barack Obama had put in about emissions. Is this the worst of it in terms of the Antiquities Act? Because you point out that Teddy Roosevelt saved 230 million acres of land for this country. And one of the best things I think that many people think a president can do, that preservation. I know in my own state of Connecticut, anytime we lay something aside as open land that can't be developed, people are excited about that. And they want to use it for good purposes of hiking and exploration and just enjoying the vast outdoors and the beautiful landscape that we have here. So this bears ears. When this went down, you're talking about 85%, about 1.3 million acres that were then stripped away from what Barack Obama had said we should preserve. Right. What happens to that land? Does that just get opened up to any private interest?
Well, there was an immediate rush to, you know, of course, it was discovered that fossil fuel industries have had a hand in the remapping of the New Bears Ears. But truthfully, it's not a resource-rich area. So it's almost like it was another thing that Trump did out of spite, almost, and to please Orrin Hatch, who was so powerful in Utah. He also reduced a neighboring national monument, Grand Staircase Escalante. And my half joke, half reality is he did that because of the name of the president who declared it, which was Clinton. But that actually, that speaks to what you're talking about in Connecticut. So generally, when they put these big areas of land aside, there are howls of protest. There are howls of protest in Congress. Sometimes there are howls of protest locally. And Grand Staircase Escalante, which has been there now for, you know, since the Clinton administration, those howls have quieted. And the cities, I mean, the towns that neighbor Grand Staircase have thrived economically as, you know, having that as their draw for people to come. And they no longer howl. So, you know, the immediate upset often turns into a long-term benefit. And, you know, it just makes sense that with space at such a premium, with the world so crowded, overheated, that we would put more land aside rather than opening it up. I mean, it's kind of a Noah's Ark, right, for the climate change era. We want to leave more as it is. We want to leave species as they are. We want to leave trees as they are, because it's really one of our only hopes.
Roosevelt came to the West as a sportsman hunter, and he wanted the blood of bison and other game animals, and then he changed his mind. I thought that was one of the most fascinating things, that given enough time, this man, reading enough, thinking enough, and being visionary enough to see what the Anthropocene could mean as we went forward as it relates to the environment and how protecting these lands and these animals was going to be so important to our own future.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, he never quite gave up his enjoyment of killing things, but it was on, you know, ultimately it was on a small scale compared to, you know, what he was protecting. And a great case would be Yellowstone, where everybody talks about the arch and it says for the, you know, for the enjoyment of the people. But I always think, yeah, he was doing it for the enjoyment of the people, but he was also saving the big carnivores and he was saving the ecosystems. And I do think his thinking evolved. And one of the really exciting things for me is I think, you know, he falls prey to certain prejudices, certainly when it came to Native people and other areas. But his great thing that he sees beyond what most of us see is he is not anthropocentric. He isn't just human-centered. He's able to see beyond the human to the world and see ecosystems and see that things matter. Things that matter to animals and plants and trees and fungi are, if not as important, are vital and important just as things of man are.
And when you look at other presidents, and I'm not just talking about Donald Trump, but has there been anyone since him who really had this appreciation? Here he was, a son of the East, And yet he loved the West. And talking about him going out on a camping trip far away from the pressures of Washington and living under the stars for a bit. I mean, that seems so foreign to us. And that was a much simpler time for presidents to exist. But as you go back and you look at the presidents that followed him, not that they've all tried to overturn what he did by any means,
right.
But has anyone had the appreciation at any level close to his?
No, would be my short answer. I would say that, you know, if you really do the acreage, including the ocean acreage, Obama passes him. And Jimmy Carter in Alaska, you know, put aside millions of acres. But in terms of that other side of it, the loving of actually being in the wild, that kind of primal delight and pleasure, not even close, I don't think. I mean, to have somebody who was president, you say it was simpler then, but he would ditch his Secret Service men to go into Yellowstone with John Burroughs and spend a day looking and studying and counting elk. He, during the 1903 reelection campaign, had his famous camping trip with John Muir, where he woke up with 5 inches of snow on him. You know, this was a guy who loved that physical aspect. And the other thing about him you got to remember is, the whole time he's doing this, he's also writing. He's like a reality show onto himself, right? He does these crazy adventures, and then he writes up articles and books and ends up, you know, publishing over 40 books about these things. So what I think of and what I crave and miss and would love to have is a leader who appreciated wildness and wilderness and who had the gift of language to articulate why it should be saved. I mean, I say in the book that when he was fighting these fights, he wasn't only doing something new, he was creating the whole arena in which the fight was fought. So I think if you had somebody with certain Rooseveltian qualities, they could do the same for climate change. They could it's very hard to articulate to people why this is something you should be passionate about. It's a vague and nebulous kind of enemy, right? But if you had somebody who could articulate it, and somebody who believed in the science, which of course as a young, you know, trained scientist himself, Roosevelt did, and then finally, you know, somebody who had the nerve, the balls, to fight the fossil fuel industries, which clearly Roosevelt did, having fought the trusts and the railroads and, you know, and not backing down. Imagine that combination in the climate fight.
It's a little hard to imagine right now.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you. Your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Leave as it is, a journey through Theodore Roosevelt's American wilderness. You said that these battles for preservation must be won and won again and again and again. Where are we today? Are we winning it, losing it? As you see with this administration, you say that Barack Obama did as much as he could. What about where we are going forward? How does it look to you in terms of the courts protecting some of these environmental regulations and such?
We'll see. I mean, it's kind of, it doesn't sound very, it's not as romantic as standing there and saying leave it as it is, but when these things are attacked, you know, we bring out the lawyers. And part of that is a little bit of a rope-a-dope, right? Until you get back in power and have the ability to do what you perceive as good. But it's unfortunate that these appointments are so political, like the head of the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management. And because what really needs to happen is the places we have already, which is our American common ground, you know, it belongs to all of us, are too often being managed in a way that is resource-focused or tourism-focused. And for them to really be kind of that Noah's Ark, they need to be left alone. We need to leave it as it is And that's a hard thing to do for human beings. You know, we're not.
Yeah,
we're
the
not
public loves. I mean, you know, we talk about it as being our best idea of the national parks. People love these institutions, if I can call them that. And they really revere them. People take out lifetime memberships. They want to go to Alaska for that reason, that they want that quiet, and they expect that it's going to be pristine. So why is that so hard for people then to make it a political issue?
Well, I mean, I think the one hopeful aspect of this is the great overlap between conservative and liberal when it comes to love of the land. And I have found, I've spent a lot of time out in the world. For instance, I went down to the Gulf during the BP oil spill, and I wrote a book called The Tarball Chronicles, and my hero was a big hunting guide named Ryan who teased me and called Obama my president. And we basically didn't get along about anything politically, except we both agreed that the waters of the Gulf and the land were being despoiled, and we were both, you know, it was our one common ground was the ground itself. So I do feel like when I'm out in the world, it doesn't feel so much like Fox and MSNBC. It feels like there is a common place, and there, that's been historically true too. After the Civil War, that was a huge period of putting public land aside, and it was supported by both parties. And along the way, it's been supported by both parties. I think the last 4 years are somewhat of an anomaly as far as, you know, just fully going after the what we've saved.
What about you saying national monuments are a place to escape our exhausted, cynical country and make us feel less central in our own story? You also write that by saving national monuments, we are helping save ourselves. Do you think we're in the business today of saving ourselves? We're so caught up in the moment. Of course, we're in the midst of a pandemic. Lives that are man-built primarily. People have been rushing back to urban areas. Now we see a little bit of an exodus during the pandemic, but still, built areas are where most of us live today and thrive economically. So what about these lands? Do we just put them aside in our mind and say, thank goodness they're there, but we don't want to worry about what it takes to continue to protect them?
Well, I disagree a little bit about the pandemic. I wrote a piece early on that was published in a magazine called American Scholar about Thoreau and the pandemic. And
Five
I do feel,
yeah,
and I do feel like we have, some of us, started to kind of look around a little bit more, study our backyards if we're lucky enough to have them. I have a creek called Hewlett's in my backyard, and learn that there can be pleasures closer to home without flying around, running around so much. So I do think that's kind of a rough draft for the climate fight, that we've, some of these lessons that we're learning are going to apply in what, you know, in the years ahead. But I also feel like you're absolutely right about the way we're trapped in this kind of house of mirrors of tweeting, self-conscious, online existence. And I feel like that looking outward and looking things other than ourselves is not just good in and of itself, but it's a healthy thing. That it, you know, it's something that can free us from the kind of prison cell of our own brains. And I try and fail a lot to do so. Even walking on the beach, you know, I think of a email I have to send. You know, Thoreau said, "You're not walking in the woods if you're thinking village thoughts." You know, so. So it's a discipline, too, to try to look outward. I was lucky enough to spend some time with John Hay, the great Cape Cod nature writer, whose grandfather was Theodore Roosevelt's Secretary of State. And John, he was in his 80s then, and it was right before the turn of the century. And he said to me, "How strange to have come through the whole century and found the most interesting thing is the birds. Or maybe it's just the human mind is more interesting than when looking outward." You know, and so I really do believe that I'm at my best when I'm not focused on me.
When you first planned this road trip in Roosevelt's shadow, and I think it's great you brought your nephew, Noah, along, what did you hope would come out of this experience for you, and perhaps even more importantly for him, because he's the next generation to pick all of this labor and all of this fight up to protect these lands, because really the climate and these other issues are going to be very germane to him and his generation.
Right. Well, I always say I don't write biographies. I write biographical adventures. And I often have a personal thread. And the personal thread here was, I was basically saying to myself, David, it's time to put up or shut up. You know, you've been writing these books about loving nature. Now you've got to become more of a fighter. And what better way to do that? Generally, to get something done, I have to write a book about it. So I wrote a book about Roosevelt and thought, here's somebody who really was a fighter. And it just so happened that my nephew Noah was graduating from college in North Carolina, where I live also. And so I scooped him up and we headed up the East Coast, and he rolled his eyes at Teddy's house at Sagamore Hill, all the dead animals stuffed. And he kept rolling his eyes as we headed west, and I listened to books on tape about Roosevelt or speeches by Roosevelt. And I think he never wanted to hear the phrase manly vigor again in his life. He's more of a laid-back kid, and I couldn't really tell, because he's so quiet, whether he was getting it, you know, whether he was. And then after the trip, he wrote me a letter, and it was about what the West meant to him. Because, you know, he'd never been out there before, and to leave the Midwest behind and suddenly be in the Badlands and suddenly then be in the Rockies, it's just an exhilarating thing. And I think we're so lucky as a country. I mean, it's a cliche, but it's a true cliche. That drive from east to west is an opening up into what Wallace Stegner called the geography of hope. And one of the simple aspects of that is, you mentioned being in the cities and crowded, to suddenly be in a place which you still can be out west where there's no one else around. I end the book by flying in a four-seat plane. I'm not doing the flying. I'm with a pilot around Wyoming and Colorado and Montana. And just to fly for, you know, half an hour looking down at trees and mountains and not see a human being, that's a hopeful thing for me.
Absolutely. Who's managing these lands today? I know that a lot of the fights have been internal, the Bureau of Land Management, the Forest and the Wildlife Service. I mean, is there a problem internally, bureaucratically, with how we're managing our lands?
Yeah, I mean, it's a patchwork, right? And some are managed by the state. And, I mean, one positive thing, I mean, it's the Great American Outdoors Act is not entirely pristine. You know, there's a lot of it that's potentially geared toward wise use, as that phrase has become, you know, more popular in terms of meaning we're going to use, not leave it as it is. But, you know, one positive is money for parks and money for management. And it's fine with me. You know, I don't like going to the touristy places, but it's fine with me if we have them. I mean, what I feel like, it's such a patchwork, but what I feel like is ultimately, as we have more people and the climate worsens, you really have to do large-scale zoning in those areas of the West. For instance, okay, here's where you do your, you know, your human thing and your touristy and your Disney thing, and here's a place where, you know, that's untouched, and if you go in there, you can walk in there, but there's no motors. You know, you're not. And then, you know, maybe even here's an area where the ATVs go. You know, but it's not working when we all overrun each other, and when you are hiking along and you see, you know, one of those horse pump fracking machines as you do now. So it's like the patchwork management to me works when it works and doesn't work when it doesn't work. And overall, that's not a great thing.
And how insistent have these commercial interests been? And what are the locals? Because you say the locals oftentimes are against this protection until they realize that it does have an economic benefit, because so many people want to come to these pristine lands. But what kind of pressures are those who really want to preserve land under today from the fracking interests and many others who want to graze and such? Is there tremendous pressure today?
Well, yeah, and the divide which we see, you know, I mentioned earlier that sometimes when you're out there, the divide doesn't feel so divisive. But then there are times, I remember I went up to Vernal, Utah, which was a big, you know, just fossil fuel town and giant white trucks everywhere. And, you know, the standard Trumpian lines about jobs and jobs on the one hand, this is what you're getting. The type of job, however, is never quite described because any sort of extractive industry is a temporary thing, right? And then you move on to the next town. Bernard DeVoto, a great Western writer in the 1950s, wrote about how, we go to a town, it booms, we suck it dry, and we move on to the next town while that town busts, you know. So, but environmentalists are fighting against this idea of jobs, and they're also fighting against the idea of government overreach. You know, like, why is the government, you know, get out of here? And DeVoto had a great line about that. He said, the Western philosophy has always been, get out, but give us money. You know, and that money means government money to help with ranching, to subsidize. Ranchers can rent or lease the government land that's our land, our national land, for cheap. And so it's a complicated, messy situation.
The battle over pipelines, is that still ongoing, or have we basically given in?
We've had a little bit of a breakthrough recently where maybe because of the pandemic and economics, there's been just kind of giving up some of the fights, but they'll never give up. As I say in the book, none of these battles are ever truly won. You have to keep rewinning them, you know, because there's always, I mean, part of it is, I mean, I'm an environmentalist, but I'm also, I like to think a little bit of a realist. And part of it's just human nature, right? I have a professor who in Colorado who is a poet, but also a mountaineer. And he said, we humans are an elsewhere. And, you know, we just are never sated. We're never satisfied. And you see that empty land out there and somebody's going to look at it and think, oh, I could make that into, you know, I could make my fortune there. I can rip it apart. And so it's just, it's can be a little depressing.
If the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is a metaphor for all that we're talking about today, we've all read where there have been encroachments on that particular piece, which is huge, of course. Tell us what's happening up there.
To me, that exemplifies the fight. Here we have a place that is the wildest place we have left. And we have caribou migrations, and we have the world working as it once worked. And for us to finally, you know, decide that we're not going to allow that anymore, that we're going to stop the world, is just criminal. And my hope is that saner minds will prevail and that we'll leave it as it is, because this is a place where if we rip it apart, dig into it, destroy it the way we've done so many other places, we're really kind of hurting ourselves and crushing hope.
David Gessner, the book is called Leave It As It Is. If I had this conversation with you perhaps 10, 15, 20 years on, do you think we would have taken that advice over the intervening period, or do you see us continuing our reckless approach at times to wanting to use the land for another purpose?
Let me give my pessimistic answer first, kind of continuing what I just said about human nature. I don't see us stopping. You know, I think like the boiled frog, we're going to gradually get used to, you know, I live in a place where the hurricanes are coming fast and furious, where it is warmer every year, where the sea level's rising. But I think we're going to get used to that as it comes, and it's going to be hard for us to repress that aspect of human nature. On the other hand, the example of Roosevelt demonstrates two things. That when the politics turn in this direction, and we got to remember, as charismatic and energetic as Roosevelt was, he was riding a tide of progressivism. It was the times. You know, he ended up defining the times, but he rode the, you know, he's like a surfer on a wave, and the wave was progressivism. But he also was a leader, a charismatic leader who didn't just follow polls or public interests. He created ideas that then public followed. So I guess my hopeful answer is, please out there somewhere, you know, if we're 10 years in the future, please let there be a 30-year-old now who, you know, is full of that same fervor and that love of wilderness, who can somehow articulate to us and excite us about this idea of leaving it as it is.
We'll leave it there. David Gessner, a pleasure to have you with us today on America Trends.
Thank you, Larry.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.